I'm pleased to say we've got a couple of guests on the line to discuss. In fact, we're going to bring in John Stevens first, Deputy Political Editor of the Daily Mail. Morning, John.
You all right?
Yeah, good, thanks. I want to talk a little bit about Donald Trump. And, of course, he's attacked Theresa May in his latest tweets. He does enjoy a good tweet from time to time. What do you make of his tweets?
Well, it's quite awkward for Theresa May and the British government. Here you've got Donald Trump saying that he will no longer deal with the British ambassador to America and hitting out at Theresa May personally and saying she's created a mess on Brexit. And obviously this comes just a month after the state visit when there was all that pomp and ceremony and things seemed going quite well. And Donald Trump did that joint press conference with Theresa May and said that what a great job she'd done on Brexit. So, you know, it hasn't taken that long for that all to be unwound. And now you've got the situation where he's trying to tell the UK what it should do about its ambassador in America. And the UK's got a choice. You know, it can either listen to Donald Trump and think, well, if the president is saying he's not going to deal with this man, what's the point in being there? Or they might just say, well, we can't be bullied by America. We can't have the US president picking who our ambassador is via Twitter. And, you know, it's quite a tricky situation for the government to be in.
I mean, this just seems like classic Donald Trump diplomacy or lack of diplomacy, doesn't it, really? Especially when he's gone, when he's talking about Brexit here. He goes, I told her, Theresa May, how it should be done, but she decided to go another way. We'll no longer do business with the ambassador, etc., etc. He does praise the Queen, though, which is lovely. I mean, is this, are we really in a bit of a tight spot here? Because if we replace Sir Kim Darroch, who's our ambassador in Washington, then it looks like we're in Donald Trump's pocket, doesn't it? But if we don't, then we don't really get any deals with America, and we need deals with America post-Brexit. So how do we play this? Do we just wait for Boris Johnson to come in and hope everything changes?
I think so. I think what will probably happen is the government will continue to say it has full confidence in Kim Darroch as the ambassador. And then after a couple of months, I think Kim Darroch needs to retire in a few months anyway.
Right.
And so I think they'll leave it for a couple of months to make it look like Donald Trump has not forced him into immediate action. And then in a few months' time, I think we'll find it's announced that he's stepping down slightly early and, you know, that he is going to be replaced. So I think they'll hold firm for now, but then kind of quietly back down in a few months' time.
John, thank you very, very much. Always a pleasure to have you on the station. John Stevens, Deputy Political Editor of the Daily Mail. Now, it is my pleasure to bring in someone to add a little bit of razzmatazz, a little bit of sparkle to proceedings. It's Blanquita Cullum, host of WCGO's Hard Question. Blanquita, how the heck are you this morning?
I'm just doing wonderful and so happy to join you all.
Fantastic. And where are you calling us from again, just so we can give the listener
an
idea?
The program is out of Chicago, the number 3 city in the United States.
Fantastic.
Very independent thinkers.
Good stuff. All right, well, look, run me through your take from across the pond on this Donald Trump attack, as it were, on Theresa May, saying that she's making a mess of Brexit. He doesn't like our ambassador. What do you reckon?
Well, you know, having served as a diplomat, the first thing, and Derek, I mean, you guys have a little problem with diplomats that have the first name Kim, I've noticed. But Kim, unfortunately, was a dope. Why would he put anything in writing that would eventually come to bite him? I mean, who doesn't understand that there's going to be somebody somewhere in your political life that will find something that you wrote and embarrass you? Now, think about it. People are saying that it's Whitehall that's actually trying to get this guy out, that he's not a very popular fellow. But, you know, he did it to himself. The sad thing is, here, you know, clearly Theresa May is not going to, you know, sack him 2 weeks before she's gone. Mm. I mean, that would show she's got to stand by her people, even though he did her a very bad disservice. Anyone who's ever served in a diplomatic capacity understands that if you have something very serious or issues that you find that are sort of sensitive, you go to a facility known as a SCIF. That means you can go in and make a phone call and speak to the people that you need to speak to, and it's totally and completely protected. No chance for a leak. So clearly, you know, this guy, I was listening to the gentleman who was on prior to me. I think it's going to be one of those classic scenarios where, first of all, you think Boris Johnson wants the baggage of this guy? Because the ambassador was not thinking of the United Kingdom. He wasn't thinking of the prime minister. He was sloppy. And he wanted to vent about what he thought about the president.
Now, is it
the president doesn't necessarily going to be the most popular person for everyone, but as an ambassador, he has to be a diplomat and protect the interests of the United Kingdom.
Does he not have a duty, though, to tell our government and fellow diplomats what his honest opinion is, really? And is that not quite worrying, maybe, for you as an American, that... Well, look, the perception, obviously, from our ambassador, whether he's right or wrong, I don't know. I've not met Donald Trump. But, you know, the perception is that he is, quote, inept and that he has got a very chaotic regime.
Nobody's going to be more inept than Kim Derrick, who's going to be giving the little commentary that he's going to leave to spend more time with his wife and his children. That's a joke. Yeah. You know, he's going to be out in his keister, because do you think a prime minister like Boris Johnson is going to want to have somebody that's that sloppy handling diplomatic relations? Of course you want to be able to share what you truly think, but you also want to know that the person that is handling it is qualified. And if anyone is inept, that ambassador was an embarrassment for the prime minister, who now not only leaves with a sad no legacy left for her, but was sabotaged by her own ambassador, who hurt her. And I'm sure she's a very nice person. That has nothing to do with her. She picked a guy who did not handle it in a very qualified way. Honestly, the United States and the United Kingdom are always going to have a great relationship. We are the biggest allies for each other.
Well, that's what I want to talk about. Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. Because, look, obviously, we are going through Brexit. And, hey, you know what? If Donald Trump has ever said anything that I agree with, it is the fact that Theresa May has left us with an unfiltered mess when it comes to Brexit. Mm-hmm. It has been absolute chaos. It's been like watching a car crash in slow motion, her premiership. It was horrific. But anyway, thankfully, this is coming to an end. Would Donald Trump have sorted Brexit by now? How do you reckon he would have done it?
Oh, I think he would have. But then again, you know, we can speculate there. The most important thing that we can probably speculate about is not what he would have done as a prime minister, is how he's going to work with your next prime minister. Mm. I guarantee you, once the new PM comes in, either one of the gentlemen, probably Mr. Johnson, everything will be resolved. Mr. Derrick will be a blip on ambassador history. And should be a lesson to anyone that be careful what you say. It's never off the record. And again, when you talk about political chess, you know, a lot of people have been saying, well, maybe it was the Russians. And maybe, look, you don't have to look that far. You look at your own people who want to get rid of someone that they don't particularly like. And how can they do it? They use something against him and they leak it to a friendly press. He was done in by his own self, by his own words and his own stupidity.
Blanquita, that is a fascinating point. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Is it about 1 o'clock in the morning where you are now?
It is. And I know that, you know, and it's, I would wait up for you all anytime.
Oh,
you know how much respect and how fond I am of you all.
Fantastic. Well, the feeling is mutual. Blanquita Cullum there. Thank you very, very much. Host of WCGO's Hard Question. Oh, I like the Americans.
Yeah.
I do. They've got a bit more about them, I think.
What, than the English?
Whiter teeth, normally.
That's true. Oh, I love their teeth.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. But they've got a bit of get up and go about them, a bit of chutzpah, you know.
Well, it's the positivity.
When you get an American paper reviewer in, Rich, you know, they come in, they slap the papers down, and they go, hey, guys, what a morning! When Paris comes in.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
It literally has a cloud.
Yeah.
There. He carries it with him.
He's got the song playing behind him at all times, Why Does It Always Rain On Me? And he sometimes interloops it with Hello Darkness, My Old Friend.
Yeah.
Anyway, he'll be in again soon.
He'll be in shortly. Really looking forward to that. Yeah. Fantastic guy, Paris McAuliffe.
Yeah.
I call him McCauley, and I've just realised I've been calling him the wrong name for the last 6 months. That's pretty embarrassing.
That is bad, actually, isn't it, John?
Yeah. Love Sport. Love Sport Breakfast. Me, Richard Lee, and Patrick Christie's. Now, the Ofsted chief inspector has called on the government to do more to increase sport in schools amid growing concern that physical education is being squeezed out of the curriculum as a result of funding cuts and excessive focus on exam results. Joining us now is head coach at Finchley Amateur Boxing Club and the man who trained Anthony Joshua, Sean Murphy. Morning, Sean.
Morning.
Good morning. Aman Spielman, the Ofsted chief inspector, is calling out for schools to keep PE and their sports programmes. How important do you feel that sport or physical activity is in a child's development?
I think it's very important. I mean, it's if they're good at something as well, it makes them feel good about themselves. If they're doing their sport they choose. And it gets rid of a lot of sports. You can get rid of your aggression, and you forget, or if you've got worries, you forget all about your worries because you're just focused on what you're doing. And it's character building, and I think it makes people better people.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's something that Anthony Joshua has spoken about, at length, really, in the media, which is that he was relatively troubled for a while. He was in a bit of trouble himself, wasn't he? And had a few brushes with the law. And the fact is, he walked into your gym and he met you, and he's gone on and become, a multimillionaire. And until recently, I suppose, he was the best at what he does. He was the heavyweight champion of the world. He had four belts. And the fact is that, realistically, Sean, he wouldn't have been able to turn his life around without sport. And, it strikes me that if we're removing that from schools, how many kids are just going to slip through the net?
Yeah, no, I think so. It's right what you're saying. And so many kids, if kids haven't got, they're not as clever as other kids and that, but they've got sport to fall back on. And look where Anthony Joshua is now through sport. So, I think it's very important, and it's very important for them to be doing exercise anyway, but you just get so much from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I mean, could just tell us a little bit, from your personal experience, how Anthony Joshua walking into Finchley ABC changed his life. What was the lad like when you first met him?
Now, listen, Josh has always been a nice person, but he's obviously, he got involved with the wrong crowd, and he got mixed up in some stuff, which if he'd carried on with what he was doing, he would have definitely ended up in prison. Mm. So that sort of saved him from a life of crime, really. And I think there's so many kids out there that it don't necessarily stop them from, it just makes them better people with sport. And if they've got a role figure, because there's so many marriages now that break up and there's one parent families. Yeah. and it's nice for some kids to get involved in sport. They have a father figure or even a mother figure if it's a girl, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that person really does help them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think, it just emphasises to me how many kids. So my partner's a teacher at a school in Cricklewood, pretty rough school, to be honest, and she has to deal with a lot of stuff that I'm very glad I never had to deal with when I was at school. There's a lot of gangs, there's a lot of crime, knife crime, etc. And the reality is that they barely have a PE department, they barely have any sports facilities, and so these kids don't see an alternative way out. They might not be good at physics, they might not be good at biology, they might not be good at maths, but they might be really good at football, really good at cricket, really good at boxing. I think it's such a shame, Sean, if we're taking it away from people. But I imagine that it's not just Anthony Joshua that you have managed to help out over the years. Is it fair to say that you're Finchley ABC, quite a lot of, I don't like to use the word trouble, but children have come through your doors and left as men, basically?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. It's right now, I've been at the gym sort of 18 years training, and I'm actually training children of the people that you trained when they were younger, do you know what I mean? So it's sort of got revolved full circle. And I've had kids come in, I think, they're going to get in trouble when they're out and all that. But they've sort of turned their life around, and it has made them a lot better people.
Yeah, fantastic. Sean, look, thank you very, very much. Really appreciate you giving us your time this early in the morning. Sean Murphy there, head coach at Finchley Amateur Boxing Club. The man who, trained Anthony Joshua, turned AJ's life around and created a British world heavyweight champion as well. So good work, Sean. Right, now, Chris McGovern is on the line, chairman of the Campaign for Real Education. Now, Chris, obviously, you're across this story, and it's basically that the Ofsted chief inspector has called on the government to increase sport in schools amid growing concern that physical education is being squeezed out of the curriculum. I know from personal experience as well, there's nothing more soul-destroying when you look out your classroom window and that area where you used to play football is now some kind of porter cabin where you teach kids geography. So, look, Chris McGovern, what is your take on this? Are we doing enough for our children to offer them sport in schools?
We're not doing enough, definitely not doing enough. And I would go as far as saying it's a crisis, it's critical. Because obviously, we've just heard from Sean, you know, young people, like all of us, benefit massively from doing physical exercise, from doing sport. We've seen a huge amount of enthusiasm across the country, across the world, for the Women's World Cup, which is brilliant. But, you know, girls, even more than boys probably, are not doing enough sport. And part of the reason is that in a lot of local authority schools, the fields have been sold off for housing development because there's been a financial crisis. The schools don't have the facilities. Too many staff are not trained to teach sport. There's a real shortage of good sports teachers. But most depressing of all, I think, is that there's a big gulf between the posh kids, if you like, and the poor kids. So if you go to a posh private school, and I've worked in both sorts of schools, go to the posh private school, they're doing sport every day. And they're also doing competitive sport on Saturdays. So they're doing loads of sport, and they're doing a great job. They make up about half of our Olympic team.
Yeah.
But if you go to state schools, many, many state schools are providing perhaps just one or two lessons a week, short lessons. They're not doing competitive sport, and therefore those kids are getting sort of left out. And their whole life chances are being affected by this. They need to keep physically fit. They need to be engaged with other people. The benefits coming from sport are enormous. And, you know, it's in crisis. So, yeah, I welcome the fact that the chief inspector for schools is saying sport's being squeezed, but she's not going far enough. This is a national crisis. We've got an obesity crisis. Mm. We've got a mental health crisis. And, you know, the odd thing is, a lot of research suggests that kids who do a lot of sport, it also helps them academically. So it helps them with their geography and their history and their science because they're doing something else. So it is, it's critical and it's a crisis.
I couldn't agree more, Chris. And I think it does, as you rightly said, it's almost elitist, this, because the people who aren't going to be affected are, you know, the posh schools. Basically, they've got, if you go to play sport against one of these top schools, you rock up, you know, they've got... Their football pitches look like carpet. You know, they've got like 50 cricket nets and bowling machines and all that, and they're all doing athletics. They've got a running track around the school. I tell you what, you know, if you just put up a school in Cricklewood or Camden up on a sports day against St. Paul's, the school in Camden or Cricklewood would absolutely have their pants down. But the fact is that these kids don't get that opportunity. And now we're just going to see a load of poshos take to the field, aren't we, instead of all these poor kids who haven't got an opportunity.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And this is a national scandal, to be honest. But even worse is the fact so much potential's being wasted. You know, we often lament the fact that, you know, we don't do quite as well as we should on the sporting front. Well, one of the reasons for that is that there must be hundreds of thousands of kids whose potential is never realised, you know, because they never get a chance. I think, you know, if we could have some sort of national campaign on this, we want every child in the country to have the right to have a sporting experience. And it's good in all respects. And I can only say, look, we've got a problem with mental health, we've got a problem with obesity, and we've got a problem, actually, with academic standards as well. All this is aided and helped and supported by doing sport. It seems odd to say if you do sport, it's going to help your mathematics. But we know from research that where there's a balance in kids' lives, they're not just playing on computer games, they're doing physical exercise. It actually helps their maths and their English and everything else as well. So yeah, it's really important that this has been publicised today. And you know, we've heard about Anthony Joshua, someone who came through. I watched Anthony Joshua in the Olympics. I watched him as a young boxer winning that Olympic gold years ago, that wasn't that. And that was a time, you know, it seemed a few years ago, we had the Olympics in London, that was going to get this sort of renaissance, this regeneration, this great enthusiasm for sport was going to spread across the country. It hasn't really happened. And if there's a crisis in our country in education, it's not just about standards of mathematics and English, it's about sport. And kids are so much happier, you know, when they're doing sport. There are some kids that don't want to do sport, I accept that. But they also need to be doing some sort of other non-academic activities.
Yeah.
And those posh schools, They don't just provide fantastic sporting facilities, they provide great facilities for music, for drama, for art, and all, and so on and so forth. So we are a divided society, and I'm not trying to say we should be punishing the private schools, but they do a great job. We've got to make sure that the state schools can do equally good a job as that, you know, and parents want this, and kids want this. Somehow we've lost the sort of thread in our lives, haven't we? What's important in life is not just about work and doing academic subjects, it's also about physical activity and getting some enjoyment from that, and staying healthy, you know. We're all watching Wimbledon now. Well, a lot of those players are public school kids. You know, from Britain, those kids who we admire, yeah, they're doing a great thing. What about the kids from the council estates? They could be great, fantastic sportsmen and women there. And we're not using, you know, we're not exploiting their potential. We're not giving them the chances. And even for people who aren't going to be great athletes, they benefit so much from doing sports. So the campaign for real education is also the campaign for real sport in school.
Oh, preach, Chris. Great! Fantastic! I love that. I love that. And you mentioned the London Olympics there that was supposed to kick on our sporting, well, prowess as a nation. It's gone backwards since 2012. 38% of English secondary schools have cut timetabled PE. Chris, thank you so, so much for coming on. Chris McGovern there, chairman for the Campaign for Real Education. I enjoyed that.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Passionate, which he's right. He's right. Yeah. It's something that, I mean, look, I would, obviously I'm slightly biased on this, but it just makes absolute sense.
Yeah, it's the whole round thing, isn't it? In the sense that all our kids now are round because they don't do any sport. Mm. You know, I don't understand where we get off as a nation doing this. You know, essentially, it's all well and good cutting funding for schools to oblivion and rinsing it dry and all that. But the fact is, if you're just churning out fatties with no academic education either, what's the point?
Well, do you know what? All the stuff we were talking about earlier, like emotional intelligence, the bedrock is a good diet and being active.
Yeah.
Do you know what? If you've got a good diet and you're active, in terms of happiness and well-being, that's a pretty good place to start.
What happens when you go for a massive run, all right? And now it will feel a bit grim, especially when you're at the bottom of that hill and you're looking up it and you're going, oh gosh, you know, I don't really want to do that. And you dig deep. You know what? You go home, you have a shower and you feel great.
It releases endorphins. You feel well-being for actually achieving the task that you set out. Do you know what I do? And like, by the way, I'm like everybody else and everyone that goes to the gym, they'll feel the same. When you actually go, you don't want to go.
Yeah.
No one wants to go to the gym. But I always make the deal with myself where I say, right, just go and do a 5-minute walk on the treadmill, then you can go home. Like that's the deal I make with myself. And I literally go. But of course, you do 5 minutes, you end up doing 45 minutes, because once you're there, you're there. But it's just that mental barrier to get over.
Exactly. I just think we're in this bizarre situation, right, where actually kids are being told, right, you've got to get an A in maths or you've got to get an A in biology, whatever. And fair play, like that, you probably should. You should certainly try for that. But it is just as worthy if you have a Coco Golf coming through your school to go, you know what, Coco, why don't you spend an hour a day, 2 hours a day on our school tennis court, right? And you are going to be, you know, you're going to be a superstar. I find it very shocking. And on to top it all off, we don't even have winners and losers on sports day anymore, Rich.
No, you're right. I mean, one of the things, this is the thing, obviously, it's elite level, but like Watford did it, and now a lot of the pro clubs do it, where 12 years old to 16 years old, if they're attached to a pro club, they might go to a specific school. They'll do their education first thing, but then they'll train from like 10:30 till 12, then they'll do education, then they'll train again. So that's what a lot of the top pro clubs do, and it was Ajax that first did this, from what I understand, and that was where Ajax had a lot of success back in the day, was that they were putting in place an environment for development, both academically but importantly when it came to sports. And I think we touched on it there, that of course this is where, you know, look, you could go even deeper than this, where people that could have the potential to be fantastic at something don't have the environment. Now that's here in England. You know, you talk about Africa and places like that, where people have got incredible amounts of natural ability, and we see so many African players now coming over here who they've got the biomechanics in order to go on and be great players, but they never have the environment. But we've got it here in England.
Yeah, and I think it is that age-old phrase, isn't it? Garbage in, garbage out. We cannot expect to be producing the next generation of top world-leading sports stars across any sport if you are stripping PE facilities and stripping sporting opportunity away from kids. It doesn't just happen.
This is Love Sport.
So go on, Patrick. What is today's Behind Closed Doors?
So, in honour a rising star in the tennis world, 15-year-old Coco Gauff, who took Wimbledon by storm, knocking out Venus Williams on the way. Unfortunately, she lost yesterday to Simona Halep, but a valiant effort. She takes home £175,000 in prize money and is set to be a millionaire, frankly, by the end of this week because of all the sponsorship deals. Now, I thought, where yesterday we did quite a big kind of mental breakdown of Coco Gauff, and a mental breakdown is something, of course, that I know all about. And so we basically were saying that one of the big issues that she's got, one of the big positives that she's got, is her mental strength. So the way that she can just, you know, walk out onto a court, just absorb all that pressure. In fact, didn't really look like she had any pressure. And it got me thinking, Rich, in the world of football, in your experience, coming through as a young player and being surrounded, seeing other young players come through and making it to the top of the game, what does it take to have the mentality of a young rising star in sports? What qualities do you need?
So there are certain, certain natural qualities. I say natural, like nature nurture. Mm. So certain things you can learn and certain things I think that you are born with. So a certain amount of confidence and whatever it might be as you grow up. I'm going to teach you something now.
Oh,
here we go. Four stages of learning.
Okay.
Okay. So you've got stage one. You don't know, you don't know. Stage two, you know, you don't know. Stage three, you know, you know. Stage four, you don't know, you know. Okay? You ready for this?
My head's just exploded.
So we use driving as an example. Stage one, if you've never driven before, you don't know if you're any good at it. You then go to drive and you realise you're not very good. So you go from stage one to stage two. You now know that you don't know how to drive. Mm. You practice, practice, practice. You now go to stage three. You become quite good at driving, but you have to really think about it in order to be good. Mm. Eventually, you get to stage four, where you just do it unconsciously. The fact that you're yawning in my face concerns
Sorry.
Me slightly.
Oh, gosh.
So the point being, stage four is also called unconscious competence, where you get to the point you don't have to think about it anymore. Now, the reason I say this is if you're a young player, whatever it is, whatever sport you're involved in, and you're coming through the ranks, you're going to start in stage one. You don't actually know. When she stepped out on that court against Venus, she didn't really know how she was going to handle the crowd. Now, she skipped several stages very, very quickly, and she's obviously got a lot of natural tendencies that are going to allow her to be confident in those situations. Because you think, how many times have we seen it where someone steps up to the plate and they just fold? Mm. You know, it's a sink or swim example that we'll give a lot, where some people, they really thrive and they love the atmosphere, love the environment, they're ready for it. Other people just crumble. You know, you make a mistake and you've got 20,000 people booing you. Mm. Or you've got millions of people on TV laughing at you. It's, you know, it's quite a tough thing mentally to be able to deal with that. But I think that was the most impressive thing for me with Corey Gauff. I've seen it with several young players that I've been with over the time, and I was giving an example to your fair, a lad called Jamie Hand at Watford, who when he was coming through made his debut at 17, and everyone thought he's going to go on and have a massive career in the game. By the age of sort of 19, 20, he'd faded out, and this was someone at 17 that was playing championship football. So I've seen the other example, Lenny Pidgley, Chelsea, played the last game under Jose Mourinho when they won the league, and played a couple of games that season. Again, within 4 years, he's playing non-league football. How does that happen? Someone that's lifting the trophy one season, 4 years later, they're not even playing professionally anymore. Similarly, people who go the other way, who have that opportunity, grasp it and thrive off it and actually learn the lessons, because they'll all get setbacks, but they learn the lessons to then kick on and be able to use those lessons positively.
I think, that is fascinating. It is that kind of sink or swim thing, isn't it? And do you think it is a case of you walk out for the first time, whether it's football, cricket, tennis, rugby, whatever, the first time you're in the big time, as it were. So in the case of Coco Gauff, Wimbledon. Mm. You don't know, do you, as you just said, when you walk out on that court for the first time, you don't know what is going to happen to you mentally. Mm. But you have either got it or you haven't.
To an extent, and this will be then a culmination of your experiences from the past. Now, the impression we get is that Coco Gauff's parents play a huge role in what she's done. And actually, a lot of the training, probably similar to Tiger Woods, will be in the mentality. You know, I always remember reading the story about Tiger Woods where his dad would stand a few yards in front of him and be like, all right, chip it over my head.
Yeah.
You know, and the pressure that you're instantly putting on. Because one of the biggest issues with training as opposed to playing, and we had this with football, is you could turn up to training, a bit easy ozy, you go out, you do your goalkeeping drills, do a five-a-side and go home. Well, that doesn't mirror what happens on a Saturday. You're not feeling the pressure in training that you'd feel on a Saturday. So one of the best coaches I ever came across, a guy called Dave Allred, who was Johnny Wilkinson's kicking coach. So he got his MBE the moment that Johnny Wilkinson put it through the post against Australia back in the day. He got his MBE and he's gone on to do some great stuff. He then worked with Luke Donald, and Luke Donald became number one in the world. He now works with Molinari, who's of course won a title or two. Now, what he does is every training session mirrors a game. So, for instance, if they did a training session in golf, every single shot mattered. Every shot that you would take in that training session was recorded. The data was recorded at the end. So he would, you couldn't just go through the motions, so to speak. Everything mattered. Going back to Corey Goff and these young players, when you don't really know when you're going into an environment like that, all you'll have had is the training you've had before. So it would be interesting to know what her dad has put her through, what the coaches have put her through in order for her to go out and perform in the way she did, because she rose. You know, look, she was tired yesterday. You could see that maybe it was a step too far, but actually to get through the three rounds in the manner that she did, and she showed so many strengths, such mental strength. You say natural, it'll be partly natural, it'll be partly the environment that her parents and her coaches have created.
And I'm quite keen to get, because I think that football is going to go down the route of, we're going to see more and more teenagers playing at the top level, because there seems to be a thing at the minute, and I think it's hard to argue with it when you see the results, where if you are a 16, 17, 18, 19 year old lad, or in the case of Coco Gauff, a girl, a woman, you know, if you are fearless, you've never known really any failure in your career, you've only been at the top of whatever age bracket you've been in, and you've been parachuted into the first team, that surely has a big part to play, because you clearly have an element of natural ability. So, you've got energy, you've got youth on your side in terms of your physique and your body, but you also only have known success. And I am wondering whether we're going to see more Coco Gauffs in the world of football, cricket, rugby, etc.
So the term experience is used a lot. People always say, oh, we want a team, want to get an experienced pro in. Now, that's great. You know, for instance, in a football team, you want to have one or two older players who have got the old head, who can then tell the younger ones and help the younger ones. Now, experience is great if your experiences have been positive and actually you've learnt the right lessons from those experiences. You know, talking from personal experience, having played in semi-final of a playoff game where I made the mistake that cost us, and then for 6 months I was pretty much in a state of depression, didn't want to know anything to do with football, that's not good experience. I'm not going to be a good person to be around a squad at that time because of what I was going through mentally. Whereas actually, if a lot of your experiences have been positive, or even if they're not positive, you've managed to come through those and still find the positive in the negative, then you can start to impart knowledge and help those around you. And I think that's key. With Coco Gauff, she's before all that. She's stage one, going back to the four stages of learning. She has no idea what's going to happen. She could have gone out there against Venus Williams, lost 6-0, 6-0, been absolutely devastated, and we've not heard of her for 10 more years, or maybe never. You know, that might have been a 15 minutes of fame. The fact that she didn't, she's now going to be so pumped up, the fact that this has gone as well as it possibly could have, really, that this should then allow her to kick on and go and have a fantastic career.
Rich, that was fascinating, my good man. Thank you very much. I like delving into your mind.
Yeah, it was so fascinating. You just yawned your way through.
That's
it.
Not you. Don't do that. It's the aircon. It's my girlfriend snores in her sleep like a hog. You know, it's just that's all that was.
Yeah, okay. I do appreciate your honesty. Fantastic. That was Behind Closed Doors.
Love Sport.
Love Sport Breakfast from me, Richard Lee, and Patrick Christie's. Now, as an athlete, you rely on your talent, the amount of hours you spend practicing, your teammates, the fans, and occasionally pure luck. That's why it isn't so surprising that some incredible athletes have developed certain superstitions along the way. Joining us now to talk us through some athletes and why some athletes develop these superstitions is Professor Kerry Cooper, CBE. Morning, morning, Professor.
Good
Kerry.
Morning to you guys.
Good morning.
It's Professor Sir Kerry Cooper to you, Richard.
Oh, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
I take it back. I apologise profusely. We've got a long list of athletes here that have some rather odd superstitions. First and foremost, why do athletes develop superstitions?
Well, they do it for a variety of different reasons. I mean, one of the reasons is something happened when they did the thing before and they were successful at doing it. So, for example, you get some athletes touch the grass, football players, they'll touch the grass because the last time they did it, you know, they did really well. They scored two goals. They had a really good game or whatever. So they link a particular thing, wearing particular socks, doing particular things, crossing themselves before the game starts. All of that stuff that you see is usually linked to, I did it once, and then when I did it, something positive happened. So it sticks with them, even though, you know, when they do it and they lose, they continue to do it again.
Yeah, so really the main hook for this is the fact that Rafael Nadal, who is taking Wimbledon by storm, he's looking to reach his first Wimbledon final since 2011. He has got quite an impressive array of superstitions or tics, I suppose you could say. So he touches seven different parts of his body before serving. He touches his backside, both his ears. He touches his nose and a few others as well. We've all seen him do it. He also bounces, also bounces the ball several times, a set number of times. I believe it's seven. And he won't cross the white line on the edge of the court unless he's unless he's got two towels in his hand. There's loads of stuff going on with Rafa. Why does he do that? Is it?
It sounds obsessive compulsive to me, frankly. I mean, seven times, you know, hitting the ball has to be bound seven times. I mean, that's just their routine. It makes them feel secure. You think about it. It's all a security blanket stuff. You know, if I do the following, this is the routine I do, then I'll be able to, you know, shoot an ace. No question about it. And that's what they think. And it makes them... It's the routine, in a way, for an athlete is quite important, whatever that routine is. And once they get into it and they've been reasonably successful, not in every game, for example, but over their career by doing that, then it reinforces that behavior and they'll just continue to do it and they won't stop. And if you tell them to stop, say you were a coach and said, I don't want you, you know, bouncing the ball seven times and then hit and then doing your ear twice. Well, I just want you to bounce the ball once or twice and then just, you know, serve and forget about it. It would affect him that's his routine. He feels secure and comforted in that routine or doing that particular thing they do.
We've got a few interesting ones, actually. We've got a list here of some of the more famous ones. So Bobby Moore, he insisted... Oh? Ah, yeah, we've got the tune playing. Of course we have. So Bobby Moore insisted that he would be the last player in the change room to put on his shorts before a game. Pepe Reina's one worries me slightly. Former Liverpool goalkeeper, he always did two things the game before. Firstly, he always had a ham and cheese sandwich with a couple of glasses of wine. And on the day of the match, he always had to fill his car up to the brim with fuel. Which is absolutely no sense. Of course, Tiger Woods, famous one. He'll always wear a red shirt on a Sunday. I think we know that. We've touched on Rafa Nadal. John Terry, centre-back, or was centre-back at Chelsea, deeply respected his teammates. Fans loved him. He would only use one specific urinal in the team's changing rooms. Could never use any other ones. And LeBron James, I like this one. LeBron James, apparently he has a different handshake for every single player in a team, a secret handshake for every single player, and that was again part of his pre-match routine.
It's quite impressive to remember all that, isn't it? Bjorn Borg, every year he would grow a beard before the tournament and would not shave it off until afterwards. So Borg did it every year at Wimbledon. It looks like it worked. It did work because he won in 76, 77, 78, 79 and 80, so not a bad return.
Am I right in thinking, though, superstitions to an extent can be quite limiting?
They can be quite limiting, but if it provides them with a sense of security. Incidentally, by the way, it's not just the athletes, the football players, the tennis players. The fans do the same, you know. In football, I go to Man City, so I'm a Man City supporter, and I'll sit next to some guy, and he says, I'm wearing the socks again, Kerry. Yeah. You know, for a big match. And they're the same goddamn socks guys had on. I said, did you ever wash them?
Oh, I hope he does.
But we do. Fans do the same thing. Yeah. I know somebody who drives to the game in a particular way on a really important match, and no matter what the traffic's like, it's got to be that way there because if I do that, they'll win.
Yeah, I do that. I do it with my eyes closed. Just one of my superstitions. What about if you have something like, I used to have a lucky stone, and then I lost my stone. So then, obviously, it sent me into a spiral. So, like, it can be limiting when it's something you can't control, right?
Yeah, it is. And I wonder, you know, you think about where a lot of this stuff comes from. Kids have silkies, loveys, teddies when they go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, and I have grandkids right now, and there's one... there's no way they will go to sleep without that specific teddy. Even if I can get an identical one, but doesn't smell the same, she won't go to bed. So we start early with these security blankets, and that's what they are. And if you're successful, then you continue to do it because it gets reinforced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody who doesn't have, well, certainly not that I'm aware of anyway, any obvious superstitions is Nick Kyrgios, who obviously got knocked out by Rafa Nadal at Wimbledon. Now, he is somebody who is quite notorious for going out very often the night before, you know, matches and stuff like that. And I just wondered, is there almost something psychologically with him where it is a case of he is too afraid to show that he cares in case he loses?
Yeah, that could be, no, absolutely. And no, you know what that is? That's about, then the excuse is, I went out last night, he loses.
Yeah.
You know, it's a rationale. Mm-hmm. So say you go out, say a football player, well, they don't, football players, but tennis players can. Because football players are actually brought together, aren't they, the night before, and they have to be in the hotel or whatever.
Yeah.
I suspect that is a way of rationalizing if he loses.
Yeah.
So I went out last night. Probably shouldn't have gone out. That's probably why I lost. In a way, it's quite a good one, too, because that gives him an excuse.
Mm. Yeah.
And if he wins, he says, God, I won, even though I went out last night.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. Sir, Professor Sir Kerry Cooper, thank you very much for your contribution. Security Blanket, 32 years, still going strong.
Love Sport.
All Systems Joe. Joanna Konta's carrying the nation's hopes at Wimbledon after a gutsy win over Kvitova. And Tyson Fury has vowed... I can't say this, like, you can imagine what Tyson Fury has really said, right? Fury vows to KO Fat Ruiz and make him spew marshmallows for a month.
Uh-huh.
That's nice of him, isn't it?
Yeah.
From a bloke who weighs 19 stone.
The thing is, Tyson Fury, you see, now he can start to do that because he was overweight, whereas now he's in pretty good nick again.
He is. But the real hook for this is apparently Dele Alli has cemented his relationship with girlfriend Ruby May by asking her to move back into his £1.5 million pad. Now, it comes after they spent her 24th birthday yachting around the Greek islands on a yacht that costs about £4,000 a day. But Rich, it got me thinking about really extravagant footballers' holidays. Because we see quite a lot of them in the press at the moment. Various players out and about in Ibiza, particularly Miami, of course, where Jesse Lingard got in so much trouble for that that video that he put on social media depicting his rather raucous stay in a hotel room, which included Marcus Rashford and one of his friends humping a pillow, which was weird. So what were some of the most extravagant holidays that you have heard about in the world of football from your kind of former colleagues, teammates, or just people that you know on the scene?
So in terms of extravagant holidays, it tends to be the standard ones in the summer. So it tends to be, you mentioned there, Dubai, Miami, Vegas are the classic destinations. It does seem that Vegas, pretty much the first weekend in June, most footballers, in fact, not most footballers, but that's where the majority will go. The first weekend in June, if you're in Vegas, you are undoubtedly going to bump into a lot of different teams ordinarily, because it will be teams that go out. They'll go for like a long weekend, Thursday to a Monday ordinarily with Vegas. And of course, it is quite extravagant there because you can't have anything but extravagant. And then what will tend to happen is actually everybody in the football world knows of a guy, I'm going to give him some advertising, a guy called Tony P.
Right.
Tony P sorts everything out in Vegas. Every single football team, every single footballer goes to this one guy who sorts out everything in Vegas. And it is always extravagant. It is, you go into clubs, it is the tables at the front of the club. It is the pool parties where you get your own little section, your own jacuzzi and all that kind of stuff going on. So, yeah, I mean, look, that's just kind of like a standard thing in the summer. In terms of yachts and other bits and pieces, I do think that's top-end Prem. You know, I think that's top-end Premier League.
Right, okay, yeah, because, I mean, it's a bizarre thing, isn't it, that they've just got so much money, haven't they, that they can just splash it around like no tomorrow. I mean, some of your teammates must have been pretty flashy.
Yeah, they were, but they weren't, do you know, they weren't too bad. I think, again, I go back to when I was playing at Watford at the time, even when we were Premier League, it wasn't, even now, like we're thinking 7, 8, 9 years ago when I was at Watford, how much has changed in the last 10 years?
Mm.
You know, 10 years ago, the average wage at Watford might have been £5,000 a week. The average wage at Watford is probably 10 times that now. Like, the inflation in football has been like no other industry in the world. If you actually consider it, in the Premier League now, what they're earning to what they're earning 20 years ago is probably the multiple of 100.
Yeah, it is bizarre, isn't it? Because I can't quite work out exactly where all this money is coming from.
Mm.
Because I get that you get your TV money, etc. And, you know, if you get further on in various competitions. But that isn't enough, is it? Like, what you get for winning the Champions League isn't enough to counteract the amount of money you've spent to win the Champions League.
No, the majority of clubs are always slightly in debt. The increasing wages and everything just increases with the more money that comes in. But it is just effectively TV rights. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember we saw there was a stat, wasn't there, about the actual ticket sales, how small a percentage that now represents in terms of the income for a club.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, when I've made points in the past, actually, I was probably wrong about the Newcastle issue, which is the stay away. You know, stay away. If you're that angry with Mike Ashley, you think that he's just presiding over a hot mess there at Newcastle, he's, you know, it's an absolute shambles, almost don't go to the game then. Mm. Actually, that's not going to hit him in the pocket that hard, is it? Mm. I mean, it'd be embarrassing for him, but he doesn't really strike me as the type of man that blushes easily.
As long as they stay in the Premier League, he doesn't care. And it'll be interesting this summer already, the fact that they've obviously sold Perez, you know, they're one of their star players for the amount they have. Rafa Benitez, they haven't continued his contract, of course. You get the impression that he's seeing it as a bit of a cash cow. Now, as long as he can keep the team to be good enough to stay in the Premier League, then he's fine because of the amount of money that comes in. And of course, what happens is the more money that comes in, it's all relative, the more they spend on wages because they need to stay in the Premier League. They need to go on and teams need to go on and win the Premier League, the likes of Man City. And of course, you're going to keep paying more and more. And all these players have got such bargaining power. If you're a top player and you're wanted by Real Madrid, Juventus, Paul Pogba's going to have it now. He's wanted by top teams. He's going to demand the biggest salary that he possibly can because they're going to keep outbidding each other until he gets to the very top dollar, at which point he'll deal and he'll get a fantastic contract. But it is all relative to the amount of money that's coming into these clubs, which then going on to your point initially, in terms of extravagant holidays, like you say about $4,000 a day. Well, Dele Alli's earning, what, 15, 20 grand a day? Does he care? You know, he's still profitable for that day.
Yeah.
A day spent on a yacht and he's coming out with a profit.
I think that's bonkers, isn't it? The idea that you can go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, you know, wake up at 7 in the morning and you have made several thousand pounds while you've slept.
Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's your dream, isn't it?
Oh, what's it like, Rich? Tell me what it's like.
I've never got to that level, unfortunately.
You're doing well for yourself. I've seen you. I've seen your car.
My whip.
Your whip. Your number plate. What's your number plate?
I'm not going to say my number plate.
Why not?
Does it matter?
Yes.
So it's R4L, so Richard Anthony Lee.
Yeah.
Space.
Yeah.
Space in the wrong place.
Right.
GK.
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 Goalkeeper. That's a nice one, that.
Yeah, well, I run the goalkeepers union, don't I? So.
Right, of course.
Head of the goalkeepers.
Absolutely, yes. And when are you going on strike?
We will soon. We are treated unfairly. That is true. We are treated unfairly.
First day of the new season. It's like when Ascot was on and the rail workers went on strike, you know, and it's like at Glastonbury, all the sniffer dogs are going on strike. And now you, the goalkeepers, first day of the Premier League season, we're going on strike.
You can imagine just the first game, there's no goalkeepers.
Yeah.
Refused to turn up today.
Manchester United have won 27-23. Just want to touch on the cricket quickly because it is the first of the World Cup semi-finals today between India and New Zealand. Obviously, England will be taking on Australia at Edgbaston on Thursday. So we'll be keeping you abreast of that as well. And basically, Virat Kohli has come out and said this is one of the toughest cities in India, captain. One of the toughest situations that you can get in Test cricket. You have to be absolutely precise. Whichever team is more brave in being calculated, I think they stand a better chance to win. So look, it's a clash of the two different egos or two different characters really here. You've got Kane Williamson, who's the captain of New Zealand. He's a very measured, quite softly spoken chap who just quietly goes about his business. Then you've got Virat Kohli, who is the total opposite of that.
Yeah, he really is. Now, promises to be fascinating. We're going to move on to a little bit of Tour de France because Geraint Thomas lost time on two of his Tour de France rivals as France's Julian Alaphilippe took the yellow jersey with a solo win on stage three. Joining us now for all the latest from the Tour is cycling journalist Felix Rowe. Morning, Felix.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thomas appears to be falling away slightly. Is that fair?
Oh, I think it's a bit unfair, really. I mean, he lost 5 seconds yesterday. There was a very spicy kind of uphill ramped finish, and there was a slight split in the peloton. So he was given the time with the main group. And tellingly, his teammate Egan Bernal was in the group just ahead. So I suppose psychologically, there's, you know, you can write the headlines there with the kind of question over whether or not it's Bernal or Thomas who's leading Ineos this year. You know, Bernal has kind of struck first blood, you could say. But it's 5 seconds, really, when it comes down to it. And so Thomas is still right up in the mix. I think he's he's seventh on general classification, kind of a, you know, 40 seconds down, and the riders ahead of him aren't big rivals, so, you know, barring Bernal. So I think it's a bit too early to say he's kind of falling by the wayside, but it does set it up to be quite interesting with the dynamic there with Bernal.
Yeah, well, it was a good day for Julian Alaphilippe, but left it late with his attack, but timed it to perfection.
Yeah, it was a classic Alaphilippe. I mean, before the stage, lots of people have said that this was kind of one markdown for him. I think he even had a text conversation with his Quick-Step teammate, Bob Jungles, who's not at the race, but then Bob Jungles put that up on Twitter afterwards, and they were saying, oh, I think I'm going to attack tomorrow. I might even go for the yellow jersey. And that's exactly what he did. He attacked with around 16 kilometres to go on one of these. There was a succession of kind of steep climbs in the kind of champagne vineyards around Epernay. And he just kind of he rode clear, and no one responded. He's not seen as a threat for the yellow jersey, and so the big GC riders were happy to let him go. And the current, the former yellow jersey, he was off the back because he was struggling a bit with these climbs. But yeah, he held on and he took a win, and he won two stages last year. He's already got one stage this year. He won the Polka Dot jersey last year as well, and he's a winning machine. He's won a race in every. He's won a stage in every race he's done, I think, since last year's tour, and he just keeps on picking up these wins. And also the first yellow jersey for France in 5 years, which is good for the home nation, on the day the race went back into France after 2 days in Belgium.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.